Okay, let's start with a little bit of background information on you. Could you state your full name, please?
Elizabeth Ann Cherry.
And your date and place of birth?
Halifax, 39.
Okay, could you describe your educational background?
Well, I graduated from Queen Elizabeth High School and then went to Dalhousie University and earned 3 degrees at Dell. Bachelor of Arts degree with first class honors in history, a Master of Arts in history, and a Bachelor of Education degree. Then I did postgraduate work in history and historiography at McMaster University. And I have an honorary doctoral degree from St. Thomas University.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about your research interests. I understand that your own historical interests have included Indian affairs, and really quite before it became a widely used area of historical inquiry.
Well, that's true. My master's thesis at Dalhousie was on the Mi'kmaqs in Nova Scotia up to the establishment of the first reservations in 1834, so that took me back to the year dot almost, and I did a fair amount of analysis of land claim settlements and educational systems and the impact on the social life of the Mi'kmaqs at the time, which you're quite right, it was before most anthropological studies had been done, and so most of it was original research.
How did you become interested in this topic?
A couple of things. I'm a native Nova Scotian, and at least at Dalhousie at that time in the master's program, there were no other people that had quite the same sort of historic roots. My parents, at least my mother, was from a rural community and had a lot to do when she was growing up with Mi'kmaq children and others, and sort of a natural interest in the historic roots of Nova Scotia. And it was a new area, brand new area, and there was lots of good first-class material in the archives that had been cataloged but never used.
Okay, so how many years have you been associated with St. Mary's?
Came in 61 as a part-time lecturer in history and became full-time in 63, and I've been here ever since.
Okay, how has your role changed over the years?
Well, I went from a straight academic into a combined academic administrative period, and then, of course, now it's straight administration.
Okay. So what was it like to be a staff member when you first arrived at that early time?
Well, it was interesting because, of course, I was not very much older than most of the students in my day classes, and certainly younger than just about everybody in my evening classes. The university was all male at the time, as you're probably aware, and except in the evening division there were some part-time students studying there, and they were women. The size of the university, I think, is probably the area where I've seen the most drastic change, in that there were less than 300 students when I came here, so that at least all of the students knew the faculty and administration by name, and you'd know a goodly number of them, you know, yourself. More than half the students lived in residence at the time, so that there was a very, very different kind of spirit here at that juncture. And it was the early 60s, and a great deal of discipline that would certainly not be acceptable, I'm sure, to people nowadays, but there was a dress code, and the students were expected to wear shirts and ties to class at all times. And most of the classes started with a prayer and things of that nature. So very different flavor, small college, very much evidence of the Roman Catholic influence at the school at the time.
Mm-hmm. So what changes do you see take place after women were admitted? I know you were closely associated with the women in residence.
Well, I was the first dean of women, because we had women students in the university population 1 year before they became eligible for residence, and so I went from being dean of women to dean of residence for women students, as well as keeping my full-time teaching job, so I had a little bit more energy at that time. Two things I think happened. One was the very rapid increase in the population of the university, which was one of the reasons why we went that way, but I'm not sure if the other thing ever materialized, and that was the sort of, I suppose in a crude way, the idea that we needed to improve the locker room image and language of some of our students, and by introducing the women we would do that. I'm not sure it's really happened, but if anything it may have gone either way.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let me see. You were here as well when the Jesuits withdrew and it became a secular institution.
Yes, yep.
What type of effects did that have on the university?
Well, I think that a number of things happened at roughly the same time, namely it becoming coeducational and therefore growing very quickly, much more quickly than any other institution was at that juncture. So that rapid growth and the withdrawal of obviously the very strong influence of the church created a fairly unstable period, in my opinion, at the university in terms of trying to establish a type of philosophy that was relevant for the students that we had and also capable of being managed within the institution, because there were still a lot of archdiocesan traditions at the university. Some of them still exist.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let me see. So you say there was less than around 300, you said?
300 students.
Students. So what was the faculty, the size of the faculty?
Well, it was very tiny. More than half of them were Jesuits, and I don't know if you know very much about the Jesuit philosophy, but they often move their members around from one institution to another, liking to give them, I suppose, a broad base of experience. So it was not unusual, for instance, for a person to be president of a university one year and then to go as head of personnel or head of maintenance at another institution the following year. So there was a fair turnover of Jesuits teaching here at the university. And I was the first full-time woman in the 60s that was teaching here. And,
Oh, really?
So most of the people were either young males or Jesuits, so it's different.
Well, you must have had some interesting experiences being the only female.
Oh, yes. Well, there were a few people doing lecturing and tutoring for the students that were women, but...
Okay, in the mid-70s, unionization of the faculty was taking place. What effect did that have on the institution?
Well, I wasn't teaching by that juncture. I was in here since 1973. I think it set us on a path that some people would say led to a great deal of professionalism. I think other people would say we lost a lot of the spirit and the inner strength of the university, because it tended to have the faculty on one side, the administration on the other, whereas in the Jesuit period there was a lot more interaction between the two, and the same philosophy as well. So kind of a bit of a unionized game that goes on, I suppose, but it may have happened anyway. I don't know if necessarily that the Jesuit withdrawal had that much to do with it.
So over the years that you've been here, can you describe the changes in the academic programs and course offerings and that kind of thing?
Well, I suspect that the most important one is the fact that when we were very tiny, some of us were expected to teach a number of different courses. I mean, I was responsible basically for 10 different history courses. And, you know, you have expertise in some areas, but you don't have the depth of knowledge in some of the others. So that I think that was true in many areas, because there were departments that only had one or two individuals in it, and yet we were trying to offer a relatively good diversified program. So that the knowledge base of a lot of us that were quite young in a few areas was weaker than perhaps, certainly than weaker than it is now. And the range of courses that students had to choose from in history, for instance, would be about 15, because only 2.5 of us teaching at the juncture. Whereas now, if you look in the calendar, as you undoubtedly have, there's, you know, upwards of 95 or something like that. I think that's true not only in my own discipline of history, but it's true in a large number of other areas as well. Because there was a limited course offering at the time, when I first came here, there were 21 credits required for a degree program, and 15 of them were laid down. Registration was easy, because between doing the 15 that you needed for your program, and the rest were always in your major, so that the question of students getting the right courses or wrong courses was really not an issue.
Mm-hmm. Are there any new academic programs there?
Well, there's been a huge number added as well. So it's not only the depth within the existing ones, but a few overall new ones.
Okay. What new ones?
Well, all you need to do is take a look, and you probably can do this faster than I can, take a look at a calendar from 1965 and compare it to with all of the areas that have coordinators now, such as Asian Studies and Atlantic Canada Studies, and International Development Studies, Women's Studies, Image Studies. All of those are new. And I suppose the easiest way to say is all of the interdisciplinary programs are brand new. And what we had initially was a very, very structured but a very straightforward type of university.
Doing my research in women's studies. I came across your name a couple of times in conferences that had been held across the country. Yeah. So did you have much of a role in the implementation of the women's studies program here?
No, because by that point I really was not involved in the so-called academic side of it. I guess some people say that I'm a bit of a pioneer, not only because of what I was doing here at the university, but I got very involved in their collegiate athletics and was the first woman president of the Canadian Inter-University Athletic Union, CIAU, and did two terms in that role, and was also the first president of the Atlantic Universities Athletic Association. So in those two roles had a fair amount to say and do, shall we say, with intercollegiate athletics and the role of women within intercollegiate athletics.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what changes have you noticed in regards to the student population over the years in terms of gender, age, ethnic origin?
Well, we always had, and this was one of the things that really attracted me to St. Mary's at the beginning and which kept me here in my first years, Jesuits were always very strong in trying to have a good mix of students. And it was easy to some extent for them because they had very significant high schools in a large number of countries in the world, and they frequently would admit students from Hong Kong, for instance, who had gone to a Jesuit high school there, or from the United States and things of that nature. So the mix of students has really not changed that much in terms of ethnic origin. The age, students are certainly becoming older in terms of their average age. Younger students slowing their program down, and a significant number of more mature students, you know, beginning their programs at the university. That, however, you know, goes back to the Jesuit days, because the community outreach of the university was always fairly significant, both in non-credit and then gradually into the credit area. I mean, we were expected as young faculty members to be involved on a gratis basis with some of those extension outreaches. I remember doing a course in great books with one of the Jesuit priests, and another year doing the debating society directorship and things like that. So that was one of the changes that came about later, with people not putting as much into extracurricular things, but it was expected at the time when we first came here.
Mm-hmm.
I find the students are much more aggressive now than they used to be. That's both good and bad. I think intellectual curiosity is an extremely good thing, and I think probably when I came here, and certainly looking back at my own days, students were rather passive and not prepared to start an intellectual argument in a classroom or discussion. So I think that is useful. I find, for instance, across my front counter listening to students, that some of them are extremely rude, and I don't think they're going to go very far in the outside world if they don't, you know, quell that temper and that aggressiveness. So, and I'm not so sure where they're going to learn to do that, but until they do, they're not going to be terribly successful.
Mm-hmm. Have you? Do you think that the nature of the student's family background has changed over the years?
No, I really don't. We always, from the time I came here, had a core of people coming from the Halifax metropolitan area, at that time primarily from Roman Catholic families. Some of them, two and three generations, had gone through the university. But we always had a significant outreach into rural Nova Scotia. And I've often said that, although Dalhousie is my own alma mater, that if I were to compare in very general terms the students, either in my own day or now, I'd say that we have more students from blue-collar families than Dalhousie, and I think that's a very legitimate role for this university, and it's one of the reasons why I've wanted to stay.
Mm-hmm.
You see that at graduation with the parents and the real excitement that comes from, you know, that kind of success.
Mm-hmm.
Does that fit your
yes,
situation?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. What do you think students wish to gain from their educational experience at St. Mary's, and do you think that's changed over the years?
Yes, I think it has. I think that there's a more of a thrust now, and it's understandable, but it's a little bit sad as well. For students, assuming that a degree will automatically equate into a job, so that the skills for work, the workplace, seem to be more what a lot of the students are looking for, rather than a chance to literally mentally grow and develop and mature within a fairly cocoon-like situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I see that a lot when I hear some of the students arguing about, what courses they want to take or don't want to take, I suppose you might say, for electives and things of that nature.
Okay. How have the research facilities at St. Mary's developed over time?
I think you'd have to look at it in terms of different types of programs. Certainly, I think in the historical area, with the new technology and with the proximity to the archives in Dalhousie and things of that nature, there's a gold mine here that's not even begun to be tapped. And I think, though, in some of the other areas, in the pure sciences, for instance, there have been certainly some progress. People have done very well with research grants, which have enabled them to purchase specific types of material. But I suspect that, like any university in a smaller urban center, we lack sometimes the opportunities that will enable us to attract and more particularly keep some of the prime researchers. In Toronto and some of those cities have a huge amount more to offer, both in the industrial side as well as the academic side.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
let's see. Yeah, I'll just add a PS to that. I guess one of the concerns that I've always had, and I guess it's a growing concern, is whether some of the university faculty members, and I've certainly talked to a few of them about this, whether they're really keenly interested in teaching or whether it's just a means to an end, the end being research. And I think you have to look for a balance, particularly in a smaller undergraduate university such as we like to portray ourselves as being.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what do you feel that St. Mary's has particularly to offer students?
Well, you know, I was attracted here because it was small and it had sort of a hands-on, sort of caring attitude. And I think that some of us that go back into the older period still try to keep some of that. Now, it's not easy, for instance, as a registrar with 8,700 students currently enrolled and others, but the kind of attention which we try to put in things like a convocation booklet, grad booklet, for instance, and our registration booklets and everything, sort of still have enabled us to carry forth some of that philosophy. For instance, one of the saddest things for me is that I rarely have ever see a student directly in this office now. I obviously can't see 8,700 students, so I have to put a screening device on my front counter to find out what the student wants to see me about, and 99% of the time have to direct them either to a dean or associate dean or student services or something like that, so that you tend to get a little bit further removed from the students and therefore not as responsive as quickly to what some of their needs might be. But I still think there is that hands-on, unevenly distributed now throughout the university, no question about it. But there aren't too many universities where you can literally go down the hall as a student and make an appointment to see the president.
Mm-hmm.
And you can still do that.
Okay, so in what areas do you think improvements need to be made?
Well, I think the biggest challenge, and I'm not so sure it's an improvement, is I think we have to decide what is our maximum size in terms of student enrollment. And that, I think, has to be very carefully orchestrated in terms of what our physical plant is capable of doing and holding either now or with some expansions. I also think we have to decide whether we're going to stay basically as an undergraduate university with a few specialized areas of grad studies or whether we want to open the door a little bit more broadly to grad studies and even do some PhD work. I mean, there's certainly the capabilities in some areas in terms of staff and facilities to do that, but I think we're at a juncture now where we have to make our minds up that way, and I think the jury's out as to what our best role is that way.
Okay, is there anything you'd like to add that you've noticed?
Well, I guess this is a bit of a criticism, and I mean it quite the way I'm going to say it, is that having been responsible for the residence in part when it opened, I'm very disappointed in the way the residence has turned out as an adjunct to our campus, and it's my own personal philosophy that successful residence requires the heads of that residence to live in. And I certainly had to when I was responsible for the women, and to my dying day I'll say that, you know, you can't be expected to be successful as a director of residence unless you're going through the same conditions as the students themselves. For instance, I didn't need someone to bang on my door Monday morning at 9 o'clock and say we didn't have any hot water all weekend, because I was living there and I didn't have any either. And so it was a very different feel. Now, mind you, that goes back to the early 70s, where there was a very different philosophy to students. But, you know, a residence can be a tremendous asset to a university, or it can be a tremendous detriment.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some of the universities, for instance, the prime place to live is in residence, in the study quiet areas and things like that. But that's been a disappointment for me, because that's a huge expenditure for us every year.
Okay.
Okay. Does that help a little bit?
Yes, I think so.
Good.